Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, AI is fueling a boom in massive data center proposals across Pennsylvania, but lawmakers are divided over how much oversight the industry should face. We talked to Spotlight PA reporter Kate Huangpu about the debate over energy use and what the rapid expansion means for communities across the Commonwealth. The Shoulder Check Initiative, encouraging people to reach out, check in, and make contact. It's a mental health movement that's gone beyond the world of hockey. We'll learn more. And a popular Catskills barbecue restaurant is changing hands. The Smoke Joint in Livingston Manor is passing the barbecue baton to the team behind Smoked Catskills. And an upcoming hands-on broom-making workshop. That's all coming up after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump is scheduled to hold a cabinet meeting next hour. It was supposed to be at the Camp David presidential retreat, but Trump moved it to the White House, citing bad weather. It's not clear if he'll focus on negotiations with Iran to end the war. Trump has backed away from his weekend statement, saying a deal with Iran was essentially reached. In Gaza, the violence of war has collided with one of Islam's holiest holidays. Less than 2 weeks after Israel killed Hamas's top military wing commander, Israel has killed his successor. NPR's Anas Baba reports from Gaza City.
NPR observed three missiles leaving an apartment on one of Gaza's busiest streets Tuesday night. There was no warning. The strike killed Mohammed Aouda, who had only recently taken command of Hamas's armed wing. Gaza health officials say his wife, two sons, and daughter were also killed. Their funeral was held on the Muslim holiday Eid al-Adha. Just days ago, thousands gathered to bury his predecessor, Izzeddin al-Haddad. Israel describes these men as the architects of the October 7 attack in 2023. Even during one of the holiest moments of the year of the Muslims, the war does not pause. For now, the cycle of succession and the cycle of death continues. Anas Baba, NPR News, Gaza City.
In the U.S., Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton has defeated incumbent U.S. Senator John Cornyn in the state's runoff primary election. President Trump endorsed Paxton, a longtime Republican loyalist, last week. Brandon Rottinghouse is a professor of political science at the University of Houston.
This is really the end of the Bush era of the Republican model. Cornyn symbolized the traditional Texas GOP that had come to power in the early 1990s and had been so successful for decades, that business-oriented, institutional conservative that has a pragmatic streak, was effectively defeated last night by Ken Paxton, but also as a proxy by Donald Trump.
He spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Stocks opened higher this morning, extending a tech rally from yesterday. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrials are up nearly 200 points.
Both the S&P 500 index and the NASDAQ closed at record highs on Tuesday, while the Dow backtracked only slightly from its own record set last week. Tech stocks tied to artificial intelligence continue to drive the rally. Memory chip maker Micron Technology saw its market value top $1 trillion this week. The company's stock price has more than tripled this year. Crude oil prices continue to soften on hopes of a deal to end the stalemate in the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. benchmark is now below $90 a barrel. Retail gasoline prices are still elevated, though, averaging just under $4.50 a gallon. A report from the Conference Board shows high gas prices are weighing on consumer confidence. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. Officials in southwestern Washington state are looking for nine missing people from yesterday's industrial accident at a paper mill. A chemical tank imploded. It killed one person and injured nine others. The U.S. military says it conducted another deadly strike on an alleged drug boat in the eastern Pacific. The Pentagon says one alleged drug trafficker was killed and two others survived. The Pentagon says the Coast Guard is looking for them. The U.S. has attacked dozens of similar boats and killed scores of people. The Trump administration has never provided evidence of their links to drug trafficking. Authorities in Democratic Republic of the Congo and Uganda continue to respond to the Ebola outbreak in their countries. Now, neighboring nations say they're ramping up preparedness and monitoring efforts. NPR's Michael Koloki has more.
Rwanda's government says it's maintaining surveillance along its borders. This follows a recent announcement that it would deny entry to foreign nationals who had traveled to the Democratic Republic of Congo within 30 days prior to their arrival in Rwanda. In neighboring Tanzania, the government has put in place enhanced public health measures at border points, with authorities in Kenya and Zambia undertaking similar actions. South Sudan's government recently said it is carrying out monitoring activities and has initiated response measures for any potential Ebola cases. Earlier this month, the Regional Economic Bloc, the East African Community, to which both affected countries hold membership, called on partner nations to intensify cross-border coordination. For NPR News, I'm Michael Kaluki in Nairobi.
And I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Strawberry.me, whose career coaches offer professional support to help people get unstuck, gain clarity, and move forward, whether advancing in a current role or choosing a new direction altogether. More at strawberry.me/public.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. The Pennsylvania House has passed bills in recent months aimed at regulating the massive data center projects popping up across the state. The proposals range from a mandate to disclose energy and water usage to a requirement that data centers pay into energy assistance programs. All four passed with at least some bipartisan support, but they face a major hurdle. A top lawmaker in the Republican-controlled state Senate says he doesn't, quote, think we should be looking at individual bills right now, end quote, on data centers. Jason Dole spoke to Spotlight reporter Kate Huangpu about what's next for PA data centers.
I would say there's definitely popular concern amongst the lawmakers, right? Like, there's a lot of different lawmakers from different parts of the state, both sides of the aisle, both chambers, that are concerned about this. That being said, you know, it takes a lot for legislation to pass in Harrisburg. There's two different parties in control of the chambers. And really, the first hurdle is leadership. And so if there's, you know, a handful of folks who feel that it's going to be a difficult vote for some of their members or something that's too tough to tackle, especially as, you know, there's a big election in the fall, then it might take a back burner.
And so what's the leadership saying in the Senate?
Yeah, so I spoke with the Senate Majority Leader, Joe Pittman, and he basically said that he's not sure that this is something that is going to be imminently addressed, you know, in next month's budget negotiations. He wasn't super concerned with the specific bills that were passed in the state house thus far. He said he is more concerned with the issue, you know, as a whole. You know, he did sort of flag that he's concerned about the impact that these data centers could have on local communities, but balanced that with wanting to make sure that the state is still trying to develop and encourage new economic investment. So he was pretty noncommittal overall to any specific pieces of legislation, but sort of nodded to the wider issues surrounding data centers.
Right. And, you know, before I say anything about, you know, Republican leadership in the Senate kind of sounding like they want to have it both ways, that's kind of also what I was hearing from the Democratic governor of Pennsylvania back when he, you know, kind of gave his budget address a few months ago. You know, it sounds like he was talking about both the importance of having data centers come, but also the importance of mitigating their impact.
Yeah, for sure. Governor Shapiro proposed these things called grid standards. We haven't heard too much about them, but they're basically transparency and energy standards that data centers coming to Pennsylvania could meet for accelerated permitting. So this is something, it's pretty indicative of Shapiro's position, right, where he wants to make sure that data centers are coming. He thinks they're a good thing. He's touted, you know, this $20 billion investment from Amazon Web Services for building data centers out in Pennsylvania. But at the same time, you know, he would want to incentivize them to make sure that they're not going to impact consumers' electricity prices, to make sure that they're acting transparently, that they're going to benefit the community that they're going to be located in. But these are, I mean, there's supposed to be incentives rather than regulations. We still need to hear more about what these look like. There haven't been too many details yet. But that's sort of a key point, right? They're not required. Data centers aren't required to follow these standards. It's just a plus that they do.
Well, that's the Senate and the governor. How about the House? The House is working on this, right?
Yeah, I mean, the House is the chamber that passed all these bills that I was covered in this story. And so they've definitely taken on a more active approach, you know, passing bills that would create pretty comprehensive regulations over data center development that would mandate disclosure of energy and water usage. Another bill would sort of create template or model ordinances for townships that are facing like oncoming data center developers. That way they have some sort of basis for regulation. So that's a very active approach, especially compared to the other, you know, bodies involved. That being said, you know, nothing ever passes in its final form. So this is sort of like an opening salvo to what could be an ongoing data center development discussion. It's sort of to be determined as to what that will look like.
Maybe let's get into some of the details of this legislation. I understand that there is legislation that passed the House that would direct the Public Utilities Commission to enact binding rules for data centers. You were saying right now a lot of what's out there are kind of like suggestions. This is looking for binding rules. You called this the most comprehensive legislation that has passed on this issue so far. What is this?
Yeah, so this bill would basically give the PUC authority and dictate it to create rules for how data centers interact with, you know, like utility companies and the sort of wider energy system within Pennsylvania, like the sort of how it interacts with the grid. It also mandates that you data center developers, you know, use clean energy, or at least a portion of their energy has to come from clean energy sources. It would tell data centers to pay into programs that are focused on energy efficiency for low-income Pennsylvanians or finance new clean energy projects. So it's pretty comprehensive. The stuff with the PUC, the State Utility Commission, would mostly dictate things like, you know, making sure that data centers put down money if they're going to have a contract with the utilities. That way, if they ask a utility to build, to contribute, you know, a certain amount of energy over X amount of years, the data center can't just pull out with no repercussions, right? The right. Other things that the bill does is sort of, it's a lot of guidelines. It's a lot of sort of setting standards, things that don't currently exist because we haven't had, you know, energy developers need this much energy en masse in a while.
Right. And you note that, you know, the bill would leave a lot of the ultimate details up to the public utilities, but they are trying to put some guardrails there on the data centers. Now, you're also looking at a couple of bills that are about making these centers disclose how much water and energy they use. What are the details of those?
Yeah, so one of the bills applies to data centers that use, I think it's more than 100,000 gallons of water each day for over 30 days. So these are, you know, that number is pretty comprehensive. You know, most data centers, I believe, use more than that, at least most mid-sized data centers, and the ones that are now being developed in Pennsylvania are larger than that. And so it basically mandates that data centers have to submit a report to the Department of Environmental Protection that includes, you know, how it plans to use the water, included where the water is going to be taken from, and then sort of proof that the amount of water used isn't going to impact the people who live near the data center. One of the other bills applies more to energy usage as well. So it would also include, you know, the amount of energy the data centers are using, and ask data centers to make predictions about how much energy and water usage they're going to use in the future so that DEP and the state government can have a better sense of what kind of impact these data centers are going to have on people's energy and water.
And now the next type of legislation that you're looking at would impact townships. Now, as I understand it, part of the reason that there's this boom of data centers in Pennsylvania is essentially due to statewide regulations about zoning in townships and how much townships can or can't do. What's this legislation about, and does it impact that dynamic at all?
Yeah, so townships are sort of the first hurdle for a lot of data center developers, right? Like, they have to get approval for wherever they're going to build, they have to make sure that the area, the land, is zoned correctly. And we're seeing that these local townships or zoning boards are voting down these plans because, you know, they just don't want data centers in their town. But, you know, not all townships are resourced the same, right? Like, if it's a really small township that maybe doesn't have that many lawyers, they're not going to be able to engage with, like, a trillion-dollar company like Amazon at the level that other townships could. And so the intention behind the bill was to create a template, to create a sort of basis for townships to use this language if there are data centers that are coming to their town as a sort of jumping off point. There have been some mixed reviews on this bill. I know that, you know, some township orgs supported it, others didn't. I think that some environmental orgs said that this might make it too easy for data centers to come into a town because now there's model language. But the intention, when I talked to the makers of the bill, is to sort of make it easier for townships when these data centers do come.
And now what about, you know, people that aren't doing legislating but are weighing in on this, especially environmental advocates? What are they saying about these legislation?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the dichotomy I found when I'm talking to environmental advocates is sort of there's a camp of folks who are saying, you know, data centers are here or they're coming. We can't do much about that. So let's make sure there's as many protections in place for people so that way their communities can protect themselves. They'll have their prices won't go up. There will still be energy and water availability, and these communities aren't going to, you know, be sort of ravaged by these companies coming to their towns. There's another camp that's more stringent. They don't want any data development set at all. So they want things like moratoriums on data center development and are like neutral, if not opposed to some of these bills, because the bills are accepting that data center developers are coming.
Could you give me a little detail of, like, strategically, you know, what some of these advocates are saying?
Yeah, I mean, for the folks who are saying let's have as many protections in place as possible, I think their take on the bill is that, you know, these protections are sort of the bare minimum, and data centers are already here, right? They're already in various places of the state. There's a bunch in Virginia. We're already a part of the PJM, this regional grid system, of which Virginia is a part. And so it's not like Pennsylvanians' utility bills aren't going to be impacted by this. They already are. And so by creating legislation like the HB 1834 that asks the PUC to create more stringent regulations, we're doing sort of our part in the bare minimum of what we can do to protect consumers. For folks who are more reticent, you know, I think they're seeing flashbacks to the fracking boom, where these companies are coming into town, they're promising jobs and economic development, and then when they leave, like, they say that will be sustainable, but when they leave, those towns are none the better. And so I think for other advocates, you know, from folks from the Food and Water Watch, they're saying, why are we accepting the presence of data centers at all when we could try to be stopping the development?
Yeah, it just doesn't seem that stopping it altogether is that likely when, you know, the law already is not on their side for just stopping it, A, and then B, there is this major economic push for it. There's a major economic incentive.
Right.
Bringing the conversation back to where we started, though, just like looking at, you know, where the upper chamber is, where the governor is, that it's clear that the people, lawmakers, the higher up that you go, they're concerned about all the different sides of this issue and striking a rather cautious tone. I'm just contrasting that with the urgency that we're hearing from some of the folks in these communities where the data centers are being proposed, such as in our region, there's Archbold, PA. That community has been reacting strongly. And it's just when you read those stories, it feels like, oh, my gosh, this is really urgent. This is really new major development that's coming on really fast, and people need tools to deal with it. And at the same time, you're hearing kind of a piecemeal response to that. Are lawmakers seeing the same urgency or things perhaps not as urgent as some folks would say? Can you sort through this as a reporter? Because you might not be able to.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really depends on which lawmakers you're asking. I mean, and especially if there's a data center being developed where they live, right? Like, I know there are a lot of lawmakers in the Northeast who are really concerned about this, some folks in Chester County. I think that it's an issue where there is a lot of bipartisan and popular agreement, right? Like, all of these bills passed with at least some bipartisan support. I do think it's a question of, is there going to be enough energy to get this across the finish line for at least for any one of these issues? And if not, something as comprehensive as 1834, right, the PUC bill, maybe it'll be something like mandating energy and water disclosure, something that is more bipartisan and less controversial. And so it really is a matter of, you know, how much energy is there behind this issue? How much bandwidth do lawmakers have to deal with this either during budget negotiations or after? It's hard to make really any predictions about what can be achieved. But I will say, like, I was really interested to see how much of a bipartisan issue this was.
That really stood out to you as you were looking into this. I'm just curious because you say, like, you know, whether it's in the budgeting process or after. Here in New York State, after the budget is passed, there's not typically much of a legislative session in Albany. What's that dynamic like in Harrisburg?
Yeah, there's usually a summer break after the budget is passed. I mean, in the case of our last budget session, November. Yeah, but so because it's generally thought that during election years, so midterms and presidentials, at least, lawmakers try to wrap up the budget a little bit more quickly just so they can get back to their districts to campaign and do election stuff. And so that's sort of the thought with this year as well, that, you know, people might try to wrap things up quickly. I mean, you never know. But that being said, we tend to come back in November September, October, November for a few days. Sometimes things happen then. Sometimes things happen in December in a last minute push. So it runs the gamut. It's not completely quiet, but it's definitely less active than it is now.
Right. Well, I know you'll be keeping an eye. You'll be keeping an eye on government overall, but especially this issue, and we'll all be watching for the next developments. I look forward to talking to you then. We've been talking to Kate Wong Pu, government reporter at Spotlight PA, and her work is up now at spotlightpa.org. Kate, thank you so much for taking the time to go over this with us.
Yeah, thank you again.
And there's also a map showing the growing number of data centers planned across Pennsylvania at spotlightpa.org. Still to come, the Shoulder Check Initiative, a movement built on the simple philosophy that kindness is a contact sport and a simple act that can help someone feel less alone. That's next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
This week's Retro Cocktail Hour has songs by Dinah Washington and Bobby Darin and the new exotic sounds of the Martini Kings. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music is always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's Mental Health Awareness Month, and today we're talking about a movement that began with one family's loss and has grown into a national call for connection. After losing their 15-year-old son, Hayden, to suicide, the Thorson family created Shoulder Check Initiative, a simple but powerful idea built around three words: reach out, check in, and make contact, three phrases. The movement has found strong support in the ice hockey community, with professional players helping spread the message that support can start with something as simple as a hand on a shoulder. Radio Catskills Ronald Kelson spoke with Rob Thorson, Hayden's father and founder of the HT40 Foundation, about the Shoulder Check Initiative.
Can you start first by telling us about who Hayden was?
Yeah, I can. You know, I think the shortest way or the best way to say it is Hayden was sort of the ultimate hand-on-shoulder guy. That's who he was and how he lived his life. I think a really interesting thing about Hayden, you know, outside he was obviously a hockey player. He was a really good hockey player at that. But that was just part of who he was. Ultimately, he was the glue guy in as part of the team or in a class or in a group of friends. And I say this a lot. He was a big guy, right? And I think he was like 6'3", 200 pounds, right? He was a fit athlete guy. But he was like really quick-witted and made an impression. And I think it was amazing about Hayden was you would notice him for his presence. He would walk into a room and he could carry himself. But you remembered him because of his empathy. And I think that that's a really interesting descriptor for, you know, that kind of guy. That's not typically the adjective you would apply to the 16-year-old athlete type of person. And I'm not being stereotypical. I don't mean that in a negative way at all. But I just think it was a little bit of a unique thing about Hayden. Like, he made an impression. And this idea really is all about just carrying that impression forward.
After such an unimaginable loss, how did you and your family begin channeling your grief into creating something like the Shoulder Check Movement?
It was definitely a journey. It was definitely a journey, and one that we probably never would have guessed would lead to this point from where it started. So when Hayden first passed, I think it was one of those situations where, you know, I've talked about this a little bit, you know, if 50,000 people sort of take this path every year, they've walked 50,000 different paths to get there. But there are archetypes, and I think Hayden was that type of person who was, by all outward appearances, seemed to be thriving. But obviously, him being the guy that he was in the world was trying to kind of manifest a little bit more of this hand-on-shoulder thing. So once he passed, we got a lot of letters. People asked, you know, of course, a ton of support. Really grateful for that from the community and from far beyond, especially from Hayden's hockey world, which, you know, reached across the country. People were saying things like, who's going to do what Hayden did for us now that he's gone? And once we realized what they meant by that, which was that he was the guy who brought them together, we sort of had this idea, which was like a hand on a shoulder. We can all do that. This idea answers that. We can all check on one another. So we had this initial thought, which was just, I have a hand to give. I could use a hand, right? This dual nature of what it is to put a hand on someone's shoulder. We're super fortunate in that my wife and I, we both work in marketing and advertising, so our professional networks came out and said, we want to be a part of this. And at the same time, in parallel, Hayden's hockey world and friends and community beyond hockey came out and said, we want to be a part of this. And sort of organically, it evolved into this idea of the shoulder check, which is about reaching out, checking in, and making contact. And then that was kind of came from our ad world side of things. And then from the hockey side of things, Hayden's Hockey Network, right? There's a gym in Stamford, Connecticut. It's called Prentice Hockey Performance, led by Ben Prentice. Hayden trained there, knew Ben really well. Ben is a trainer to scores of NHL players. And I'll train there all offseason. Ben was like, we should do a game. And then at the same time, the program my son played for was run by my friend Gary Zegras, and Trevor Zegras' father. And they were like, listen, we're in. Let's do something. And sort of organically, it all came together. And we launched this idea with what we called the Shoulder Check Showcase on August 3rd of 2023.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier the message, which is hand on a shoulder, reaching out, checking in, make contact. You alluded to it earlier. Can you explain to folks exactly what that hockey lingo sort of means and what those terms mean to you in terms of what does that call to action inspire you to do?
Yeah. So the notion of a shoulder check, obviously the hockey language is a pretty aggressive move, a shoulder check, a hip check, a body check. It's a physically aggressive thing to do on the ice, and kind of thought, what if we could turn that upside down and make it just as literal, but in a different context? It's about putting a hand on someone's shoulder and just asking them how they're doing. I think the best way to summarize the idea we say a lot is we might not always know who needs a hand, but we all have a hand to give. So let's check in on one another. So that's kind of where the language came from. And then that's informed everything that we've done since then. Like, our goal is to create spaces, places, and ways for people to literally put hands on each other's shoulders and check in on one another. There's a ton of great work that's happening out there, you know, at the intervention level, right? And I'm not a medical practitioner. You know, I'm an ad guy. I'm a marketing guy. So there's a ton of professionals doing great professional work. And then above that, there's a ton of work that's being done. We talk about it all the time right here. Like, let's break down the stigmas around mental health. There's campaigns out there that say you are not alone. There's campaigns out there that says it's okay to not be okay. And that's awesome. It's doing great work. And our thought was, okay, if that works talking to the person who's struggling, and that still ultimately requires the person who is struggling to raise their hand and say, I need help. Three hardest words to say in any language. They got to put themselves in a spot to allow themselves the vulnerability to raise their hand to ask for help. Our thought was, let's just get everybody involved in the conversation. Let's complete the sentence that says, you are not alone, by saying, because I'm right here beside you. You know, if somewhere between 25 and 33% of young men and women are struggling with some form of mental health challenge over the coming year alone, let's get everybody in the mix, lending them a hand to make it easier for them to say, I need help. And that's sort of the logic that flows behind this whole thing. And with that, you know, we've had so many great people get involved and help us carry that message forward.
What have you learned about how young people respond when someone does check in on them first, as opposed to someone in distress having to reach out to be checked on?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. This idea is meant to be universal. It's meant to be pre-intervention. It's meant to be something simple that everyone can do. And it's a small thing, right? It sounds like a small thing. But it sort of occurred to us, like a lot of times you see, like the biggest problems in the world start with like everybody doing one small thing. And if we're suffering this crisis of loneliness and isolation, which the Surgeon General published on a couple of years ago, like if everybody could do one small thing, it would make a huge difference. And we're seeing that happen. We're seeing it work. And, you know, I get anecdotal emails all the time, or frankly, whenever I have the chance to go out and share this idea, and whether that's with a team of hockey players or any kind of sports team, a lot of youth teams play, or we do corporate panels, we do community events, we do school presentations, invariably somebody comes up afterwards and says, you know, I felt the power of a hand on a shoulder, or I use this idea to start a conversation that I didn't know how to start before. Or even more simply, like, you know, I checked in on somebody and they said they could use a hand. Like, and I think that's amazing, just to see that a simple thing can have a big impact.
Why do you think the hockey community itself has connected so strongly with this message? I mean, this season we've seen more and more people take leaves of absences to cope with their mental health. Linus Ullmark from Boston, Victor Hedman from Tampa Bay. What do you think has resonated with them?
Yeah, I think, you know, first and foremost, the hockey community is amazing in the way it kind of turns out and supports everybody and it supports one another. I think hockey is one of those sports where, and anybody like on a path where they're trying to be really good at something, whether it's sports or otherwise, of course, that requires a lot of sacrifice, right? Time, money, travel, family, commitment, everything. Like, hockey kind of takes a village. And I think the sport and the players within it recognize that, and therefore they're really eager to support one another. And so when Hayes passed, like I said, it was that whole world of guys that trained at the gym there. They're like, we want to do something. We want to be a part of that. And since that very day, you know, guys throughout the area, guys across the country now, we hold our event. You know, those guys get on planes themselves to come out to be a part of it. But really anchored here, guys like Trevor Zegras, Chris Kreider, Kevin Shattenkirk, who have been with us since day one. You know, they've talked about it and they say they recognize, like, you can see if somebody's got something wrong with their arm or their leg, but you can't see when somebody's struggling mentally. And I think, you know, it's interesting that some of the most rugged, toughest guys in the world are the first ones to be able to demonstrate that vulnerability and say, like, we've got to look after one another. And then I think you're seeing it cascade through, right, where the league has done a great job in creating programs, players' assistance, and creating space for guys to feel comfortable raising that hand and saying, I can use a hand. And, you know, if this idea sort of drafts off that or helps inform that or is part of that, like, I think that's incredible. But, you know, everybody's on their own journey, and more people are feeling comfortable raising a hand saying, hold on a sec, you know, I got to take a break here. That's incredible progress. And, you know, those guys are incredible role models for being able to step into that space.
You mentioned NHL players with huge followings, especially here in the tri-state area, like Chris Kreider, Adam Fox, whose jersey I may own, Jonathan Quick, and you mentioned Trevor Zegras, and a bunch of other athletes as well. When they get involved and use their huge followings and platforms, What does their commitment to the initiative mean to you, and what kind of impact can that have on young people who are easily influenced?
I mean, I think it's incredible. These guys are the absolute best in the world. I mean, we've got Hall of Famers, All-Stars, Stanley Cup winners, the next generation of talent, all a part of this idea. And, you know, I think they're a part of it because they recognize the truth of the initiative, that, like, this is important and that they can be a part of it. And, you know, obviously we would not be anywhere near where we are without their support and participation. And each one of them, you know, last year, every year we try and make it a point. I say this is my language about how we're trying to do this. Like, we add a new tool to the toolbox every year as Shoulder Check, right? We started with the Shoulder Check Showcase, which now we do every year. And I'll talk more about that in a second. It's coming up. The year after that, we created an emoji that we tried to get onto phones. It was called the check-in emoji. And then last year, we were lucky enough to get the rights to use the song Lean On Me, Bill Withers' Lean On Me. And 15 of the guys came to the gym the day of our showcase event last year and sang the bars to the song Lean On Me. And we made this film. You can see it on our website, and hopefully people have seen it in different places, but it's them singing Lean On Me. And I think what they're doing there, and the reason why that work resonates and why this idea resonates, is, like I said before, here's some of the toughest guys in the world stepping up and demonstrating the very vulnerability that we're advocating for more of in the world. It's so powerful to see them as role models. And, you know, to your question, for me, you know, it makes me that much more committed to the idea that I want to honor their commitment to it. And I'm so grateful and proud of their support, you know? So another example of how the kind of circle continues to spin itself.
You mentioned the Shoulder Check Showcase. It's going to be happening again this year. What does that event represent for the initiative, and how can people find out more and get involved or watch?
Yeah, that's the big one for us. So, like I said, we launched this idea of the Shoulder Check back in 2023. And ultimately, it was in Stamford, Connecticut, was at the time, at a youth hockey rink. And it was amazing where we kind of created this, like, party atmosphere outside with, you know, lots of food and stuff to do. And then we came inside and basically had an NHL and PWHL level all-star game. And the one thing we did right before the event is we asked everybody to stand up in the crowd, and like 2,500 people came out, and everybody on the ice, led by, you know, the guys, all the pros and men and women, the professionals, putting their hands on shoulders. And we just did this really simple call and repeat. We asked everybody to say, "I promise to reach out, check in, and make contact." And everybody said it all at once, and it, like, changed the vibe in the building. Like, it was uplifting. And with that, we played this awesome game. It was incredible. We've done that each of the last 2 years. This year, it's gotten bigger and bigger. So now we're going to be at Sacred Heart University, Marchand Family Arena, which is an amazing facility. It's in Fairfield, Connecticut, like I said, on July 30th. And we hope everybody will come out. Now it's going to be kind of like a party on a college campus, a summer party. We've got, like, a little band. We've got food. We've got activities. And then we get to go inside the building and, again, have this amazing game. Then all the players are going to come out. We'll have some fun with it. We've got, like, special guests planned. We have special activities planned. It'll be super cool. And again, it's all these guys who, like I said, are men and women are volunteering. They're paying their own airfare from across the country to come be a part of this. It's so incredible. And yeah, tickets are on our site, shouldercheck.org. You can learn more about it. You can see stuff on @theshouldercheck on our Instagram handle. You know, learn about the game and the event and what that's all about. And beyond that, the event exists via demonstration of the power of this idea. So hopefully it's a place where people come out, see it, experience it, and then feel inspired to carry the message forward. That's how we're growing this thing, right? Like, giving people ways to experience what the power of this simple gesture is, and then helping support them bringing it to life in their communities. And you can learn about all that kind of stuff on our website as well.
Finally, for coaches, parents, teammates who may be listening, what are some signs that someone may need to check in? What should someone say if they're worried about someone but don't know how to start?
You know, I'll answer that question just as a person in the world, right? Because, like I said, I'm not a mental health practitioner. I don't know how to identify moments of crisis, which is why I think it's even more important that crisis or a catalyst doesn't have to be present to be the kind of person that just checks in on someone. I think there'll be times when we can see someone struggling, and there'll probably be even more times where we can't. So that's why I think if we affect this demeanor where it's a universal thing, where we're just aware of one another and we make empathy something that we do daily. You know, we say all the time, like the shoulder check is about checking in on someone on the daily. Like, that's it. Just a hand on shoulder. You know, sometimes words aren't even necessary, like literally a hand on a shoulder. And sometimes the wrong words are just as effective. You know, we're all human and we're all trying. And even if the words don't come out right, we're creating that space to allow someone to be vulnerable. And then should we find someone who's in need? Of course, you know, if it's an extreme situation, there's 988, right? There are services that are out there that we can connect people to immediately. But infinitely more common is just going to be someone who needs a hand, someone who needs pep, someone who needs someone to be beside them, or maybe someone who needs to be referred to a teacher, a parent, a counselor. You know, but the more we're checking on people, the more we're going to find them sooner, and the more we're going to connect them to conversations that will help them. So that's the premise, right? I think it doesn't need to be a moment that you're aware of. It can be any moment. But again, it all starts. It can start with something as simple as a hand on a shoulder.
Is there anything else you'd like to add before we sign off?
I'm grateful for the chance to share this idea with anyone. You know, I say, mind you, this full time now, my job is to support this idea coming to life wherever anyone sees value in it. So you can hit us up on the website and you can see it and get inspired yourself. And if you have an idea, you can reach out, share it with us. It's our job to support it. And then failing that, like, come on out to the showcase and see what it's all about, feel what it's all about. It's an incredible day and an incredible place to be.
That's Rob Thorson, father of Hayden Thorson and founder of the HT40 Foundation and Shoulder Check Initiative. Reach out, check in, put a hand on a shoulder, make contact. Sometimes support starts with a text, a conversation, or just letting someone know they're not alone. You can find out more information on the Shoulder Check Initiative at shouldercheck.org. And a note for listeners, if you or someone you know is struggling or in crisis, you can call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. In New York State, 988 connects people with trained crisis counselors 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can also reach out if you're worried about someone else. Rob, thank you so much again.
Thank you.
And thanks to Ronald Kelson for that. When we come back, a changing of the guard in Livingston Manor's dining scene. We'll find out more after this. This is Radio Chatskill.
Join the Kingfisher Project's Bill Williams for a powerful performance reflecting on the loss of his son due to opioid addiction and his family's journey through grief and healing.
If I help in some way to reduce the stigma around addiction, that makes me feel like I'm doing something in my son's honor, and that assuages, for want of a better word, the grief.
History of a Brief Time, Saturday at 5 at the Lou Beach Community House, followed by an audience Q&A. Ticket information at wjffradio.org.
I'm Jason Tuga, host of The Mixtape. I play classics you love, deep cuts, and brand new music. Friday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Chatskill. A well-known barbecue destination in Livingston Manor is entering a new chapter. After 5 years of serving smoked meats and Southern-inspired comfort food in the Manor, the Smoke Joint is handing over operations to the team behind Smoked Barbecue. The transition marks both the end of one era and the beginning of another for a restaurant that became a staple of the Catskills dining scene. Joining us now is Jennifer Grossman from The Smoke Joint and JP Medina and Sarah Banks Medina of Smoked Barbecue. Hello to you all.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
This is a passing of the barbecue baton, we're calling it. Jennifer, you've described it as that. What made you think of JP and Sarah of Smoked? Feel like the right people to continue the tradition of barbecue for you?
Well, first of all, you know, the talent and the culinary skill that JP brings to the table is unmatched. And we've been connected for years and years, way back when I was raising French guinea fowl and he was at the North Branch Inn doing some amazingly magical design with those birds. But the importance for us as a business where we established this tradition of family and connection and community is exactly what Sarah and JP are all about. As a husband-wife team, as experienced in the hospitality industry, I can't imagine anyone better than the two of them to take this to the next level.
Tell folks about why this next chapter is happening for Smoke Joint and maybe what emotions you're feeling after being such a presence in the Manor for so long.
Yeah, it's bittersweet, truly. But it's also very exciting because what we did was take a dilapidated vacant lot that was not being used and converted it into a destination restaurant for people just driving randomly on Route 17 or recognizing it as a regular to-go place. It was also a great opportunity for teachable moments. We're on the banks of the Willowemoc, which is where American dry fly fishing began. We're surrounded by Catskill Forest Preserve. So it was really a wonderful place to set a foundation that can go to the next level. And when I say next level, my brother Ben and my brother from another mother, Craig, the three of us have really focused on establishing this so someone can take it to the next level. We, the three of us, are focusing on different projects over the next few years, and we can talk about that, as you know, a little later today. But it really was the right time because there was a transition, not just in our personal lives, but in the community. We see Livingston Manor is growing in a way that can and will absorb this next phase.
And JP and Sarah, what was your reaction when you found out about this opportunity to be able to take over the Smoked Joint? You'd build up a following for Smoked in Narrowsburg.
Yeah. Shout out to Big Eddie Brewery for that one. We appreciate the support they've given us and the opportunity they gave us. But yeah, once the idea came about, Sarah's an amazing visionary, and she said, "That's Smoked. That has to be Smoked. That has to be it. That has to be it." And
I did.
And so we kind of just started, the ball started rolling there. So we reached out to Jen, had a couple of conversations, looked at the spot, and then just kind of let the seed sprout.
We were talking about this a little off air about how you guys got your start in Livingston Manor. You're kind of coming around full circle, but also just this sense of community and neighbors knowing each other and businesses. I mean, this is not typical in a business world, I suppose, or in the restaurant world, to have this kind of connection and like another type of the same genre of restaurant take over the space. Talk a little bit about that and what it means to you guys to be able to carry on that BBQ tradition.
For us, I think it was an intentional decision, right? We could have picked any lot, any spot to go into. But when we were connected with Jen, we just kind of knew, as JP mentioned. So for us to be kind of having our little bit of a homecoming back to the area and the town that started our work up here, JP and I both moved up here 11 years ago. We both started our careers up here in Livingston Manor. There's this kismet aspect to this that just feels right place, right time, and that's why it's now.
And Jen, when you were saying goodbye to folks in the community, you specifically thanked the staff and the community. What role did the local support play in your success?
Oh, critical. I mean, there was, whether it was the folks from the highway department, the library, the school, the bank, you know, all of the families in the Beaverkill Valley or up on Chandelier, you know, we had folks coming from Liberty and Monticello on a regular basis. So without that community, we could not have been as successful as we were. And again, the bittersweet feelings that I have are, you know, I loved seeing those faces come in and be excited about eating and sharing their updates and bringing their grandchildren or children or friends and being proud that this was a place in their community, in their town. And that's, again, why it was so important for us to know that JP and Sarah have that same priority, that same commitment to community. And they will take, I have full faith that they will take this to another level beyond.
JP, how do you describe Smoked's barbecue style and philosophy?
I would say, so it's somebody who had put it a beautiful way was it's our DNA, right? So it's a representation of where we started, which was basic food, my Colombian roots. And then coming to an area that is just so inspiring as far as ingredients go, creators go, purveyors go. And so Smoked is really just a culmination of all of that, right, of who we are, what we're inspired by, beautiful ingredients, delicious food, and more importantly, just that opportunity to share as a community, as a family, as friends. And so that's what we aim to nail is all those aspects, is really good food and a beautiful time.
And you're not only expanding there in the Livingston Manor, you're expanding with another concept in Calicoon, Smoked to Go.
Right.
Tell a little bit about that.
So Smoke to Go is just a taste of what we're going to be doing at barbecue. It's going to be part of just snacks to go to kind of show people what we're doing at barbecue. But it's like we're showing the Colombian roots more at to go than anywhere else. I mean, smoked in general is that, but it's going to be highlighting a lot of a combination of Texas barbecue, Colombian street food, and inspired by New York ingredients.
And just to add to that, right, we recognize that what Jen and team built is such a moment and experience in Livingston Manor. We are still a barbecue joint. This just has a little bit of JP flair in it. So you will still be able to have your mac and cheese, but a side option may be yuca fries with a chimichurri. So we're combining the best of barbecue, smoked meats, but also having that intentional flair of who JP is inherently and who his family is.
I noticed there's a few barbecue restaurants that have popped up in the region recently. There's room for all, you think?
1,000%. I think barbecue in general is a representation of who you are and what you believe in. And there's a lot of it has to do with foundation. And, you know, we're all raised differently. We're all brought up in different environments. And so this is my version of barbecue. Right. And I think, yeah, there's definitely room. Right. The briskets can be different. The sauces are different. And yeah, I feel this barbecue is huge for everybody. Everybody's got a backyard.
You got me hungry. When do you open? Where can folks get more information?
So they can definitely follow us online. Smoked_Catskills on Instagram. We also have smokedcatskills.com. Smoked is spelled without an E, just so everybody knows. S-M-O-K-D. Catskills.com. We're hopefully opening in a couple of weeks. There's a couple of hurdles we're still trying to jump over. We got to get the green light from the DOH within the next couple of days. And going from there, we'll be able to announce an official date.
But to answer your question, very, very soon. And we highly recommend staying tuned on Instagram because it might be within 24 hours. It might be a week or 2 weeks.
You never know.
You never know.
Jennifer, any final words of advice to JP and Sarah as they embark on this new chapter?
Just as you said, stay true to your heart and exactly the reason why you're doing this. Barbecue is a patient process and it gives us the time that is precious for us all to be together and enjoy one another. So I wish you all the best of luck. And I know you will rise to the level because you are the next generation for our community.
Thank you so much.
That's Jennifer Grossman of the Smoke Joint passing the barbecue baton. I feel like we should have a rack of baby back ribs to hand to you.
A brisket.
JP Medina, Sarah Banks Medina of Smoked Barbecue. Thank you guys so much and good
luck.
Thank
you guys. Thank you so much.
Now, this weekend, the Headwaters Arts Center is inviting people to reconnect with an old world craft that blends artistry, tradition, and practical skill. Fiber artist and educator Poliana Daniela will lead a handcrafted broom making workshop on Saturday. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi has the details.
So before we get into the broom workshop, can we learn a little bit about you? And what brought you to this particular craft?
I'm originally from Romania. It's a country in Eastern Europe. I was born in 1975 under communism. We had a few clothes, and we used to mend our clothes and do embroidery on them. And when my first child was born in 2014, I decided to mend her clothes, like she was wearing wool clothes. I didn't want any synthetic on her. And I thought that I was going back to my original work, which was landscape design. But after giving birth, I realized, wait a minute, I want to spend time with my child and continue some of the work that I was doing, but in the other form. I started to mend the clothes for my child, and at the same time, I started to take some workshops in Brooklyn, in Manhattan, weaving knots, bookbinding, and at some point, I decided to take the class, handcrafted brooms. The reason that I took the handcrafted brooms was my grandmother, who used to have a broom. A broom made from twigs, and somehow, I don't know, I was fascinated by that shape, and I decided to take the workshop. I study landscape design in Romania, in Netherlands, and at the New York Botanical Garden. What I'm doing now is a form of continuation because I always loved working with plants.
Can you tell us a little bit about the history of broom making?
Yes. If you ask about the ancient beginnings, it started in Mesopotamia, where they used to make those twigs brooms that I shared before in about 4000 BC in Mesopotamia. In America, it started in 1790. Benjamin Franklin is credited with bringing the broom corn. It's a type of sorghum to America from Egypt. 1797, Levi Dickinson made a broom for his wife. And somehow he opened a business, a manufacturer, and he started to sell brooms by 1800s, selling about hundreds of brooms. And the Shakers in 1797, Dickinson, he made a broom, it's called hard broom, but the Shakers started to make the brooms flat. Because they were more efficient to clean in the corners. Yeah, the corners are a struggle. The material that was used, it is still used, it's called sorghum bicolor. It's a type of grass. It's not a corn. I'm not sure why they call it broom corn. Nobody really knows because it's a grass, but they decided to call it broom corn.
As you've said, it has quite an interesting history. What do you think caused the resurgence and interest in broom making as a craft and as an art form?
Yes, I have to tell you, Valerie, that I've been teaching for the past 15 years. I started at the same time when my first child was born. And I have to tell you that broom corn is the most interesting and appealing for people. And I'm guessing that after 4 hours of workshop, you go home with a piece made by you, you know, and it's a beautiful and also usable and a piece of art at the same time. You can use it the way you want it. And I think it has to do the fact that you accomplish something like that in such a short time. Not only that, but after COVID, there was something about fiber art that people started more and more to use their hands because they were stuck in the house and they felt, okay, we need to do more creative things. And it has to do with that too.
It's also interesting to see the various shapes and colors. They become sculptures.
Yes. Yes, I usually teach the workshop with the broom corn, but also I use agave fiber, and I use horse hair for my brooms when I want to go a little bit more creative. And you can actually create really sculptural forms and a piece of art with them. I usually teach the whisk broom corn workshop, but there are different types of brooms. The sweeper, the round broom, the cobweb broom. Those are more complex and they need a little bit more time. Between 2 and 5 days I need for such a workshop. But this particular broom that I will be teaching, it's just one day, 4 hours workshop.
Is any kind of special stitching required?
I wouldn't say special. It's true. It's easier for people, for students who are crafty and they did any stitching, any type of stitching. We will have two types of stitching. In the first part of the workshop, we'll do one type of the stitching when we put the broom together. We take a little bit of break, and after, in the second session, we'll do a horizontal stitching. It's a little bit like under and over. It looks like that, under and over stitch. Yes.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing all this wonderful information about broom making and your workshop.
And, you're welcome, Valerie.
Okay. Yes. And for more information, folks can go to RoxburyArtsGroup.org.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are welcome.
Yes.
Thanks to culture reporter Valerie Manzi. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Garnet Health Medical Center, Catskills, with campuses in Harris and Calicoon, offering inpatient and outpatient services to Sullivan County and surrounding communities. Learn more at garnethealth.org.
Take a dive into the deep end, the ultimate rock music journey. Deep cuts, live tracks, and rare gems from rock, psychedelia, country, jazz, and blues. Experience the deep cuts on the deep end. Friday nights at 10, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, very warm. We might see a thunderstorm in spots late this afternoon, high 79. Thunderstorm could also pop up this evening. Otherwise, overcast and a low of 53. Tomorrow, it will be turning breezy, not as warm, and a high of 66. On Point is next.